We'll finish up Pergamum, and then if I can do that, we will briefly discuss Thyatira. And I don't expect to get done with that even, but that's just what we'll do. Remembering that these are oracles, messages from King Jesus through his now called and commissioned prophet John to this body, his people, in these various cities, these churches, and that it's a continuation of that commissioning. It's that sequence, just like you read in Isaiah chapter 6, where he gets commissioned, and then Jesus gives him a whole body of, I mean, the Lord Yahweh at that point gives him a whole body of things to say to the people of Israel. It's that same sort of sequence taking place here, and we're partway through that. So I'm going to continue on. Jerry touched on last week for me the Nicolaitans, and I legitimately laughed out loud when I heard him say the biggest sin of the Nicolaitans was that they didn't tell us what their sin was. As I was listening to the recording, made me laugh. That may be the case. Now, it made me laugh out loud because it was clever, not because it was so plainly wrong. And I don't think it's plainly wrong. I think that that's true. In fact, I agree with him wholeheartedly that speculations about certain people named Nicholas and all of that is trying to tie things together. It's trying to make something that probably isn't there entirely. It could be a code word. I've mentioned this once before. It could be a code word, play on a couple of Greek words, meaning conquering a people. Could be that, but that still wouldn't tell us what's really happening, what the teaching is. However, I think we get some insight here in chapter 2. Although they're mentioned in the message to Ephesus, they're then mentioned again here in the message to Pergamum. We'll unpack that a little bit more in verse 15, the way that that shows up there, and maybe there's something there. So let's spend the bulk of our time talking about Balaam. So I'm going to see, let me pull up in my Bible here. Go ahead and refresh. We'll read it again real quick. Revelation chapter 2, verse 12. And to the angel of the church in Pergamum write the words of him who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, yet you hold fast my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness, who was killed among you where Satan dwells. But I have a few things against you. You have some there who hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, so that they might eat food sacrificed to idols and practice sexual immorality. So also you have some who hold the teachings of the Nicolaitans. Therefore, repent. If not, I will come to you soon, and war against them with the sword of my mouth. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. So moving into teaching of Balaam, Jesus commends these people. They are staying faithful to his name. It's not like they're outright rejecting him. In fact, someone in their midst has received what we will later term as martyrdom. In other words, they testify to Jesus so much, they're such a testifier that people can't take it anymore, and they get killed on account of it. But he has a few things. They're not insignificant things. I remember when I was studying this, I just sat and meditated on it, and I thought, he says I have a few things. He doesn't mean insignificant things. So they're significant, even if they may be small in number. Doesn't mean they're small in importance. I know as I read it in English, it's easy for me to get what stuck out to me. Okay, so I'm going to nerd for a second. When I'm reading it in Greek, all of a sudden I go, wait a second, that word doesn't mean the same thing that I want the word few to mean in English. Like when I read that, oh, it's just a few of them, it's not a big deal, that sort of thing. I import insignificance with numerical amounts. And I mean, am I alone here? We tend to do that sometimes. And I don't think that's what's happening. That's not what's happening at all. He's just saying, look, you clean up these couple of things and we're good. You don't clean up. Notice at the end, That sounds pretty serious. You don't clean them up, and I'll be there soon to do something about it. So it's not that it's insignificant that they're small in number. I think that's a good warning for us, that just we don't have everything right. We just have those things could be so wrong, the things you have wrong, church. They could be so wrong that Jesus is ready to do something about it. So it's a good corrective for us if we happen to be in that camp. So what are those things? Some people there hold, notice that word hold, just like you hold fast to my name, they hold this teaching. You hold my name, they hold this teaching. It's the same in Greek, a little wordplay there the translators are trying to maintain. Hold the teaching of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel so that they might eat food sacrifice. Okay. What does all that mean? Well, you could skim right past through it quickly. You could go through it and say, okay, whatever the teaching must be to eat food, sacrifice to idols, and practice immorality. Now, you peel that back a layer, and that's not actually what it says. That may wind up being where we land. Probably going to be where we land. But if you back up for a second, that's the teaching, that's what Balaam taught Balak to do. It's not saying that that's what these people are teaching. But I want us to think about this for a second, about the whole story of Balaam and Balak. When I say Balaam, you think of a donkey, right? Okay, wrong. Yes, that's right. We all are going to, because donkey talks to him. For some reason, we never think about the angel with the sword that's about to kill him. Pretty significant. And I know that when I read it in Numbers, and I start out and I get through the part about the prayers and so forth, so on, I tend to, after that, it gets a little weird. It breaks off, and then you see his name again later on. So let's go through that together. Let's go through that whole sequence together, because I think that going through that will help unpack for us why this person, Balaam, why it's so bad, what's happening, that Jesus is ready to come quickly and make war with the members of the church who are doing this stuff. Okay, so we'll start off in Numbers 22. We're in the, we can say, Exodus event, not the initial event, but the ongoing, the wandering, the 40 years in the wilderness. Numbers in Hebrew is, the title of it is not Numbers, it's Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness. That's what Jews call it, is Bamidbar, in the wilderness. They name it by the first, remember when we talked about that, naming old ancient books by the first word? That's the first Bamidbar. So they're in the wilderness, and they've got pretty close. Here they are along the Jordan. Numbers 22, verse 1. Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. Beyond the Jordan at Jericho. So we're at that place where we should be ready to go in. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw that all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was in great dread of the people because they were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel, and Moab said to the elders of Midian, "This horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field." So he's not just threatened about them numerically from a military power standpoint. He's saying, when this mass of people moves into our region, all of our consumable resources will be gone. I will not be able to provide for anybody. They will consume everything. Our food and water will be gone. So he doesn't want them there. Balak, the son of Zippor, who was the king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the people of Ammah, to call him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." So who is this character? We'll come back to that in a minute. This character, I'm going to use that word. I'm not saying he's not historical. I'm just, for now. This character, Balaam, in the late 1960s, there was an excavation being done at a site called Tel Deir Allah, which is that red red dot right here. Here's Jericho. Ancient Moab would have been over here. Jericho. Just north of there, there was an excavation being done, and at the top of the tell, which just means the mound of earth that eventually gets built after things get destroyed and rebuilt, and they build fortifications, and it turns into a hilltop. At the tell there, excavators found this central sanctuary shrine complex, and when they went inside, on the walls, they found plastered there hundreds and hundreds of lines in, it's not Aramaic and it's not Canaanite and it's not Hebrew, but it's like somewhere in between those. So there are words that look just like Hebrew, and then there are words that look just like Aramaic and that sort of thing on there. And on there, they find hundreds and hundreds of lines that translate roughly like this: the misfortunes of the book of Balaam, the son of Beor. A divine seer was he. And it goes on to talk about the end of the world and how he woke up and was having visions of the gods destroying everything and stuff like this. And this dates from the 800s BC. So it's old. It's really old. So who's Balaam? Should we think jokey joke guy with a donkey? Or should we think a guy who was known through that region at that time frame as the dark wizard prophet who, if he sees it, you're in trouble? It seems that if we're reading like an ancient person, we're going to think, oh man, Balaam's going to show up? They are in so much trouble. Okay, you should be thinking like Darth Vader walking in and you hear the music and all of us. It's like whoever sees that, that's bad. Okay? So here comes Balaam, and there's a negotiation, there's a back and forth. Yes, there's the donkey, yes, there's the angel, that sort of, we're going to fast forward. So he attempts multiple times to stand out over the armies of Israel and look out over them and to pronounce a curse, and every time Yahweh puts something else in his mouth, and it turns out to be a blessing about how Israel's going to do well and how everything they touch is going to turn to gold. He doesn't say that, but that sort of thing. He's going to bless everything they do. It's going to work out. And so skipping on down a couple of chapters, Numbers 24, verse 10. And Balak's anger was kindled against Balaam. So he's paying him a huge sum of money. He's got all of his court and entourage there. And Balaam, in a lot of ways, is making an idiot out of Balak. And he's still got this problem of an opposing army eating up all of his resources that's not getting fixed. And the guy who's supposed to be the guy who can handle things, the great seer, wizard, sorcerer, prophet guy, it's backfiring. So he gets angry. And he struck his hands together, and Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have blessed them these three times. Now, therefore, leave. Skip down a few verses. Balaam doesn't stop talking. So even though Balak says, I'm done with you, go away, Balaam doesn't stop talking. He keeps going. Verse 15, and he took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam, the son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is open, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth. Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir also, his enemy, shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly, and one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of the city. Sort of insult to injury, like, even though you've told me to leave, let me give you one last prophecy about how you're all doomed. And one day, not near, something far off, I see this man, this great man coming out of Jacob and Israel with the scepter, and he's a star that rises, and he finishes everything. Okay. That's just what finished. Israel's going to do great. Everything's awesome. Next verse, chapter 25, verse 1. While Israel lived in Shittim, the people began to whore with the daughters of Moab. That ought to strike you as exactly the opposite of what Balaam just said. Well, you just said it's going to be great and they're going to, you know, if you're the Israelite and you're reading what Balaam said, it sounded like triumph and no problems. Next verse, they started doing all the wrong things. What did these people do? They invited the people, these, in other words, the daughters of Moab, the Moabite women, invited people to sacrifice, to the sacrifices of their gods. Catch that. And the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel yoked himself to Baal of Peor. In other words, made some sort of allegiance vow, whether it was through participating in the worship cult, intermarrying with the women who did. It's really bad on their part. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the chiefs of the people and hang them in the sun before the Lord, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." Anyhow, it gets bad from there. So plague, death. There's several chapters go by of Phinehas throwing a spear through a woman because she's not an Israelite and gets brought in. We get our first example of the zeal of the Lord consuming someone. And chapters. And you think, that's it for Balaam. Where did John or Jesus get this part where Balaam taught Balak to throw a stumbling block of women in front of? Where is that? That's not it. You think you're done with the story. So go on to chapter 31. So that's a long interval, right? As far as narrative time, there's all sorts of laws about vows and who you can and can't marry going on. And there's all sorts of this stuff interposed. Some ground opening up, people being swallowed. There's lots of bad stuff going on. So Numbers 31. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Avenge the people of Israel on the Midianites. Afterward, you shall be gathered to your people." So Moses spoke to the people, saying, "Arm men from among you for war, that they may go against Midian to execute the Lord's vengeance on Midian," so forth, so on. Move on down to verse 8. They killed the kings of Midian with the rest of their slain. A few names, the five kings of Midian. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword. So he shows up again, as now he's down with a different people group. This guy gets around. He's for hire, sorcerer for hire. He gets around. He's now with a different people group, and he loses in that war. In fact, he loses so bad that he gets killed. And the people of Israel took captive the women of Midian and their little ones, and they took as plunder all their cattle, their flocks, and all their goods. So catch that. They brought the women back with them. Drop down to verse 13, same chapter. Moses and Eleazar the priest and all the chiefs of the congregation went to meet them outside the camp. And Moses was angry with the officers of the army, commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds, who had come from service in the war. Moses said to them, "Have you let all the women live? Behold, these at Balaam's word," on Balaam's advice, some translations in Hebrew, Badebar Baalam, "Balaam's word caused the people of Israel to act treacherously against the Lord in the incident of Peor. And so the plague came amongst the congregation of the Lord." So you have to read through all of that to finally get down to the part where Moses finally tells us, way back up in chapter 25, the Israelites didn't just happen to start going to the women, to the Moabite women's worship services. They didn't just happen to start going to these sacrifices and rituals. It wasn't just happenstance that Israelites started doing this. Balaam apparently had said to Balak, "Look, we can't beat them. I can't curse them. You can't beat them. However, let's do this other thing and make them give up their faithfulness to their covenant God. Let's put something in front of them that they will choose ahead of their God. Make it something enjoyable, like food and sex." And then their own God will do it to them. So what does that have to do with Revelation? Well, it's hard to know for certain. It would be hard to imagine that there are teachers in the church at Pergamum saying, you know what we need to do? We need to go down to the local temple, and we need to worship other gods, and we need to participate in cultic prostitution, because Jesus is okay with that. Right? We all generally, that's probably not what's happening. But there's something there where the enemy has decided, I won't be able to get them to directly say Jesus is not Lord, but there are enough social pressures around to get them to compromise in these, they don't quite see it as compromise ways, these culturally relevant that are part of getting along with the people around you. Like if you're camped just outside of Moab for a long time, you start participating in the things that the Moabites do. It's far more believable, at least to me, that what Jesus is talking about, those who hold to the teachings of Balaam, are those who say, I live in Pergamum, though, Jesus. I'm not giving up on you, but I am going to go do this. Because everyone else is doing it. In antiquity, these two practices, sacrificial meals, corporate sacrificial meals, and cultic sexual practices are very common and often interrelated. So it's no surprise that that would be the two. If you look down to the next message to Thyatira, when it talks about Jezebel, that's exactly what Jezebel is also getting people to do. Now, as far as what the Nicolaitans have to do with all this, if you look at verse 15, so also in the ESV, we might need to look at a couple of, he's just talked about food sacrificed to idols and practicing sexual immorality. In other words, compromise that says it's okay for me to participate in the, what I would call the civic religion of those around me, the normal, everyday, everybody else does these things. This is not weird. It's weird not to do these things. So if you look down, in the ESV it renders it, so also you have some who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans. Any other, what are some other versions? What do we have?
Likewise, you also have those who hold the teaching of the Nicolaitans.
Okay, what else? Any others?
You also have some who follow what the Nicolaitans teach.
Okay. What I'm going for here is most of you, there are too many conjunctions and adverbs in the Greek for the English to really do something with. And in fact, there's one all the way at the end of the sentence in Greek that like none of our English translations do anything with. They moved it all the way front in yours, likewise. In the same way, okay, good. So like in the ESV, I kind of chuckled at it. So, oh, thanks. So also. Now the also is there. There's a word, then there's a word, then there's another word at the end. There's like one too many for English to know what to do with.
And New American Standard tries, I think, to capture it. It says, so you also have some who in the same way hold the
Okay. You see what they're jockeying with here. So that's why I say, I look at that and I say, it sounds to me like he's trying to coordinate whatever the Nicolaitans' teaching is as pairing going right along with this so-called teaching of Balaam.
That first word there in verse 15.
Hutos?
It means this, the foregoing, doesn't it?
It can. It can mean so. It can mean in this way. It can mean like this.
Wouldn't that be the word that's tying those two together?
That would be one of them. It appears to me, yes.
Yeah.
So I'm having, that's why the, what is it, homoios at the very end, which means likewise or similarly, at the very end of the sentence in Greek, I'm like, there's just one too many of these. And so our translators are struggling to make a good English sentence out of it because there's also an also in there. Now he said there are a few things that he has against them. So there, at least one of those, I believe, is the another one of the things that he's trying to, I'm sorry to language nerd on you for a minute, but I think it's the only way we get at what's happening with the Nicolaitans and why they show up here. Is that verse? Okay, I may put too much weight on it. If I'm wrong, so be it. I won't arm wrestle over it. But I think that's what's going on, is we have people who are not coming out and saying, defy Jesus and his people. Right? Don't stand on the hill and pronounce curses over them. Like that's not going to work. That doesn't work for me. However, if you go along to get along, we can... there's an undercut of what you're doing spiritually there. And I think that's why reading the Balaam account and reading all the way down to 31 and getting to where Moses finally says, he did this. And you realize the narrative before that doesn't tell you he did that. It drops off with, it looks like Balak failed. It looks like Balaam couldn't do anything, even though he's this dark sorcerer prophet guy who is somehow in contact with God. There's no doubt about that. He's legit as far as practicing in spiritual arts. And it says he just goes home. Well, next thing you find out, he's the one responsible for plagues and all sorts of problems. Jerry?
Back to Revelation, just from a teaching methodology, could it be that by going to Balaam, which they could relate to because it's another people in another time, it's an Old Testament teaching, had he started with Nicolaitans in this context, they might have said, what are you talking about? But by going there, and then likewise, he's able to draw a parallel to show the likeness between the two.
Yeah, I think Jesus here, it may just be that it's so stark with them that, and there may have been gradations of what this is. So like the Balaam, because I believe that this is symbolic language, I don't think there's a group saying, we're teaching the teachings of Balaam here. This is the church of the teachings of Balaam. Or we're going to have a Sunday school class on the teachings of Balaam and how you should follow them. Right? I don't think that's what's happening. What's happening is, in order to denote the seriousness, even though it may not seem serious to you, it's this serious. So I'm going to use something that gets your attention and shows you how far you will go off and how much of a problem this will be, both for me, your covenant king, and for you, my servants, if you don't stop doing what you're doing. He's being paid.
But he at the same time, he's like not able to necessarily go against the Israelites. So I'm just confused. Is it like he'll just play to either side, kind of?
Apparently he will attempt to use divination to curse anyone for the right price.
Okay.
That's the way I think Numbers portrays him. And I think when it shows up in, is it Jude? Another one of the New Testament letters, I'm thinking either a Peter or Jude. Jude, yeah. Jude, where he's mentioned by name as someone who would do wrong things for money.
But in the case that cited that we read in Numbers, it was actually the Lord.
That's correct.
Right.
Correct. He was not able to contravene what Yahweh wanted to take place. And in fact, if you read the story, there's this really rough patch early on in the story where Yahweh says, don't go with Balak, don't do what he says. And Balaam says, look, you could give me all the money in your treasury, and I'm not going to be able to say anything except for what Yahweh tells me to say. And then at the end, he brings it back up to him. He says, look, you're mad at me. I told you I'm not going to be able to say anything but what Yahweh tells me to say. Like, you paid for this, buddy. I told you up front, it's a contract. Don't be mad at me now.
It's in the fine print.
That's right. Right. So a couple of things I want to bring out. When we talked about confidence in the things, how we can have confidence in what interpretations, conclusions we're drawing, and I made points about starting with Revelation, and we showed how it's interplaying with itself some here, and then to come to some, I think, confident conclusions. And I said, go back to especially Old Testament prophets, Old Testament, that sort of thing, and the Bible in general. I think that helps us find out what's going on here. And I said, last, we need to dig around in the social historical context. And so that's where I want to spend a few minutes talking about the types of things that would be those very everyday, simple, and highly pressured things, like you really would be the odd duck and might not get what the big deal is, even though you're a Jesus follower. Like, you should get it. Like, good sound teaching should make it clear to you that you cannot have dual allegiance. Jesus said that as plainly as anything else he said. You can't serve two masters. You only serve one. However, in a pantheistic society like they're in, not pantheistic, poly, thank you. Whew. Polytheistic. Yeah, that's right. Well, it dawned on me that that's not it. That's not the right word. In a polytheistic society where people, leaders, undergo what's called apotheosis, which means to be named and then ascribed divinity, they're turned into gods, it would be a lot. It would push on them in a way that it wouldn't push on us. We look at people, you call yourself divine. No. That's, you're crazy. You're the crazy one if you call yourself divine. But that would have been normal. Okay, so let me talk about a couple of things in Greco-Roman society that would have made that sort of pressure really common and very tempting to succumb to or compromise with, so that we think, because this has been a real challenge for me, where am I doing this? Because if it's possible, I think every one of these things, there are followers of Jesus who were clearly fighting against it, who stayed clean, who didn't participate, all of those things. So I don't think it was impossible. I just think it's one of those things where there would be a significant, or at least some segment of the population, that this would be a blind spot for them. And so Jesus is saying, you cannot let it be. You cannot let it be. So first one, and I think this is probably the easiest of the three I'm going to talk about, is just your general cultic religious festivals. If you were to look at an ancient calendar for Rome, you can look it up, the Fasti. It talks about all the religious days, the holy days, and that sort of thing. And every festival, there's a god for almost every day. And there's a state-sponsored or a municipality-sponsored, a civic program for worshiping those deities. Cities, in fact, had patron deities. So if you're the only person in your family not showing up on fill-in-the-blank holiday for the patron goddess who protects our city and makes sure the crops grow, are you your family's favorite person? Can you participate in public life, like political, if you don't show up for these things? Okay, just start. So that's number one. Start thinking about that. Second one, the emperor cult. It's everywhere, and I could spend time talking about history of certain cities that spent time trying to show the emperor how they were more in love with worshiping him than the next city down the road was, and how if you send envoys and money to us and stuff, we will be the most worshiping of you, of anyone, and all those other cities, they will worship you less, and we want the, because there's money involved, as well as prestige, as well as power and authority. So we will worship. So the emperor, I like to say the emperor cult was behind every door. And we have letters from, one of the earliest letters from the Greco-Roman Empire talking about how Christians behaved is the letter interaction between Pliny the Younger and the Emperor Trajan. If Revelation is written in the 90s, this is less than 20 years later. And it's a very interesting interaction where, and let me back up to actually that slide I had of the region. He was actually here in Bithynia. So here's Asia Minor, And Pliny the Younger is a governor for the Emperor Trajan, just north of the region where these letters, these messages are being sent. He is the governor in Bithynia, and he has people turning in Christians because they don't show up to the public religion. And so part of the worship, or the emperor worship, and so part of that is to pay money to an image to show your tribute and to sacrifice a little something, and that's how you do it. So people are turning them in because they're not participating. And Pliny doesn't know what to do because he was a lawyer back in Italy, but he's never been to one of these trials, it seems. And so he doesn't understand what the emperor wants him to do about it. And he says, I've sort of taken this approach where if someone turns them in and they're brought in to me, I ask them if they're a Christian, if they're guilty of being a Christian. And if they say yes, I remind them what the penalty is for being a Christian, i.e. someone who won't worship our state gods. I remind them of what that penalty is. And if they still say no, I ask them a third time, are you sure? And I even offer them the money to just go put the money over here in the thing and say, give your tribute to the emperor and we can be done with this. And if they still say no, well, then I consider them guilty and they're punished. And of course, the punishment is death. Unless they're a Roman citizen, and then they get sent to Rome, that sort of thing. Okay. If they come in and say, yes, they're a Christian, okay, trial over. If they say no, 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 and they just worship, then I let them go. And the emperor writes back and says, yeah, that's basically the way you handle it. You're doing a good job. You know, it's a four-pronged approach. However, don't go hunting anyone down. Don't accept accusations from a third party. We don't need a witch hunt, despite what some of you may think about Rome and persecution. They weren't always on the hunt. And so don't go hunting for them, that sort of stuff. You don't want your citizens all turning each other in and all that. That's no good. But if someone shows up and they won't worship, then they're guilty. So that's behind every door, just so you know. So that might be difficult for people. That might cause some difficulty, certainly push a strain. Now, I think for most of us, we can go, that's pretty obvious. That's a pretty obvious one where I can't participate. But think about it, and this would go into the early church fathers and after the persecutions. There would be people who would say, yeah, I gave the coin, but I didn't really believe that. That was just my body doing it. I didn't stop believing in Jesus. So that one's really hard for me. So I just want you to think about that one. The last one, and one that we might not be so familiar with, or probably the least familiar with, are what are called the collegia. We get the word colleges from it. And a collegium, this is an inscription, a funerary inscription a guy had done that basically had, I know you really can't see it, but it's hundreds and hundreds of words in Latin. And it's explaining the foundation of the college that he's at. Now, just stop thinking institution of higher learning. That's not what it is. Think trade guild. So if you're a stonemason, your town probably had a government-sanctioned stonemason's guild. And if you wanted to keep being a stonemason in your town, you had to pay monthly fees to be in it, and you would pay a buy-in on the front end to become a member of this association, and you would go to their events, and the events are great because most people in the ancient world don't have enough money to do big sacrifices and a big feast and that sort of thing. But if all of you are chipping in a little bit, then several times a year, you can just have a rager together, even though you're sort of lower middle class type of folks, and you don't really get those sorts of things like the wealthy, the royal, the noble. They get to debauch themselves regularly. You don't have enough money to do that as often. So it's nice when you can have it. So parties, and all of these parties, these big annual events, in this particular one, there were six big ones a year, according to this guy, and they were just blowouts. But of course, every trade guild has to have its patron And you don't have a blowout rager or a meeting of the guild unless you do what first? Sacrifice to that God. That's right. It's a lot of pressure if your dad was a stonemason and your brothers are stonemasons and they're all members of the stonemason guild. And so have you been all up until this guy came to town and started telling you that there's a King Jesus and you've started following this King Jesus. And now if you want to participate in the guild, what do? Do you give up your job for Jesus?
I'm guessing it's not a right to work today.
Yeah, that's right. Also, one of the key features of the guild, a collegium would be, and he spends like a third of his time talking about funeral arrangements. That's important in a society where the practice, all religious practices determine whether or not the God is pleased with you. So the way you do it determines whether or not you get to pass on into the next life. So you want to make sure the people who are handling your funeral are going to do it right. So trade guilds, collegia, all over the place in the ancient world, and important for Revelation because as we read on, or as you read on, there's going to come a point in John's visions where if you don't take a certain mark or worship a certain image, guess what you don't get to do? You don't get to buy, sell, or trade, do you? There may be some relationship between those concepts. So there's a lot of pressure for even the average Joe in what would be this small community of people who are following Jesus that might not seem, I can still go, okay, I'll show up 5 minutes late to the guild meeting and then I will already have missed the slaughtered pig, but I'll still eat the pig because, you know, I haven't had pig in a couple months. Is that okay? So I'll kind of leave all that stuff. That is looming in the background of several, it seems, several of the messages here. Is state cult worship, imperial cult worship, standard religious festival, which I think is probably one of the easier ones that they were able to deal with, and then these collegia that people would have bumped into and had problems with. It would have affected your family, your as well as your finance. And there is no, religion is tied up into all of this. So Jesus is saying, you have got to get untied. As I realize, I'm not going to even finish Pergamum again. I guess I kind of want to land it on, so what are some things in our society that even members of the Christian community, those who call themselves followers of Jesus, have decided it's acceptable because it's so widespread. It can't pop. I just want us to internalize. Yeah, I just want us to internalize some of that. Are there places where civic religion, in other words, doing, giving mixed allegiance, because that's normal, is hitting us in a blind spot, even though the gospel is calling us to think differently, act differently. Notice that Jesus isn't just talking about what these people believe. In other words, this is not just an existential or an internal issue here.
Right.
It's what they actually do. Right. Right. So if the, that's a good, let's take Daniel 3. What I think, to use that as an analogy, it would have been like the three Judeans going ahead and bowing down to the image, but telling one another, but we don't believe it. God won't be bothered because we don't actually believe that. it would affect the way you testify, doesn't it? Jesus, who and John in the Revelation, who's so concerned about what testifying looks like and being faithful in the way that we testify, seems to be saying it's not okay to just say, well, I didn't believe it when I did it. Yeah, my body's there and participating, but I'm only here to reach them. Well, maybe that was true the first two times you went, and after that it's because you enjoyed it. Something like that. I don't know. Fill in some blanks. Questions on that stuff? Jerry talked about warring with the sword of the mouth. I think that, I mean, like I said before, he talked about that last week. I think that reading that any other way than symbolic creates all sorts of problems for you. Unless you think Jesus is going to do sword combat with members of his church. Doesn't seem to make sense. And since there are so many places that's used as an image in the Old Testament, seems more likely the case. And then the promise at the end, we'll discuss hidden manna, white stone, new name another time. Questions? All right, I'll pray, and then we will... Oh, you got a question. Okay.
There's some thoughts in terms of trying to carry that forward to today.
Mm-hmm.
We obviously live in a different culture.
Right.
But undoubtedly, the enemy is subtle and finds new ways to package everything. In our day, of course, we have alternate worship services on Sunday available for all who might prefer to go and spend their day celebrating and sacrificing at great cost to engage in it. And then, of course, there's the other side of that is they were dealing with what they were sacrificing to false gods. You know, I'm going to do this and this. We deal with what sometimes we won't sacrifice to the right God, which may play into it. Just thoughts.
Make some interesting points here. Thank you.